is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Cochran, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning and welcome to this virtual Court of Appeals this morning for this April 14 panel of the court. We've had some technical issues this morning and we may continue to have some, but we'll try to work our way through it. The case on for oral argument first this morning, I'm going to try to pronounce, is it Guyon versus Commissioner of Human Services and Carver County Health and Human Services. And I'm sure counsel will correct me if I'm mistaken on the pronunciation of the name. For the sake of the audio recording, we are presenting our argument today by Zoom. Counsel, we are making an audio recording of the presentation today, not a video recording. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of the argument, because we do post our arguments online. This way individuals and listeners can connect counsel to the different arguments. I will tell you in advance that I have been having a little bit of technical issues. And so if it gets glitchy, I may ask you to pause and we'll try to fix those problems. Otherwise, we'll just plot our way through. We've had some connectivity problems with one of the counsel this morning. And please somehow notify us if you are disconnected or you cannot hear either the counsel opposing you or the court and asking questions today, and we'll try to deal with those technical issues and work our way through it. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Ali Afsharjavan. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Minnesota, and I represent the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services in this matter. This case is about trust assets and medical assistance eligibility. There was a county decision on an MA application, an administrative appeal, an appeal to the district court, and then an appeal to this court. While on appeal to the district court, the trust assets at issue were spent on Ms. Guyon's outstanding facility bill, and Ms. Guyon became eligible for MA. Ms. Guyon later died before the matter was heard and decided at the district court. The commissioner requests the court to affirm the decision of the human services judge at the conclusion of the administrative proceedings below and reverse the district court because the assets in the trust could have been used to benefit Ms. Guyon, thereby making the trust assets count under federal law. And second, by operation of state law, the irrevocable trust actually became revocable when Ms. Guyon applied for MALTC, thereby causing their assets to count towards MA eligibility limits. Either is a sufficient basis for this court to affirm the commissioner's decision below and reverse the district court. However, I'd like to briefly discuss jurisdictional issues raised in this appeal first. They were raised to the district court below and here. When Ms. Guyon passed away, no party substituted afterwards. So the district court did issue an order when the only parties to the case were the Commissioner of Human Services as well as Carver County. Without any substitution, it appears that the district court lacked standing, or there was no standing or subject matter jurisdiction for the district court to issue its decision. The commissioner, however, was aggrieved by the decision below by the district court and therefore appealed the decision. Once this matter was appealed, counsel for respondent did file a motion to remand this matter to seek some substitution. The commissioner opposed that motion because this court can rule in favor of the commissioner on the merits, and it would remove any need for a remand. In addition, the trust assets at issue were in fact spent down and used to pay for the cost of Ms. Guyon's care, and therefore they were used to benefit her. So the matter is also moot in that regard. Should this court decide that there was no standing for the district court to issue its decision below. And should the district court, or I'm sorry, should this court decide that there's still no subject matter jurisdiction here, the commissioner requests that this court vacate the district court's order below. However, as stated in-
Counsel, I'm actually confused by the subject matter jurisdiction argument. What is your position as to what happens to the claim after she dies, since it was still a pending claim? She was an aggrieved party, or she claimed she was an aggrieved party. Is it your position that the claim disappears?
No, Your Honor. It is possible, and that wasn't really argued below necessarily, because a public assistance appeal is about the correctness of the administrative decision below.
But you're arguing subject matter jurisdiction, which is an issue that can be raised at any time. So you raised it. My question is, what's the legal basis for saying we don't have jurisdiction when she dies?
And Your Honor, I'm not saying that this court doesn't have jurisdiction. The commissioner did appeal because it was a grief party below, but the district court, when Ms. Guyon passed away, no party was substituted, and the case cited in the briefing of the commissioner, I believe it was Glaze, that stands for the proposition that an attorney ceases to represent a party when that person dies and no party is substituted.
The Glaze case, though, seems to me to be distinguishable, because that case was a criminal case, not a civil case. And at the time of the appeal, the individual had passed away. So the individual wasn't alive when the appeal was filed. Here, when the action was filed in district court, the individual in question was still alive. And so factually and legally, it seems distinguishable. So I'm not sure why Glaze would be controlling here. And in addition, under the rules of civil procedure, there isn't a time limit for filing a motion for substitution.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Glaze case is a little bit different in what the case was about. There is a case from 2010, In re Roskies, I'm sorry. And that case is a little bit similar. The district court dismissed the trustee after the MA applicant had died, and then ruled in favor of the commissioner, I believe, in that case. And then that got appealed, and this court did not have to really decide whether or not any sort of substitution was proper, because the commissioner's decision below was correct. So as we stand here today, no party has substituted into this case yet. But nevertheless, the court can decide this on the merits, and the commissioner is asking the court to decide this appeal on the merits. So I would like to get into that, Your Honors. First, under federal law, and a decision favorable to the commissioner on the merits should remove any need for a remand or any further need for a substitution. So under federal law, if there are any circumstances in which an irrevocable trust could be used to benefit a MALTC applicant, then those do count. In this case, towards the asset limit. In this case, the trust provisions at issue, they prohibited any loan or gift to Ms. Guyon. And that was really it in terms of any sort of restriction. There was no specific language that prohibited the trustees to pay for the cost of her care or to pay out a outstanding facility debt. But regardless of that, Your Honors, Minnesota law makes irrevocable trust revocable when someone applies for MALTC. This law came on, I believe it was in 2005. It was codified under Minnesota Statute Section 501B.895 in 2005. It's since been recodified to 501C.1206. But the substance of the law was in place when these two trusts were created. And the law is fairly clear that when someone applies for MALTC, that irrevocable trust becomes revocable for the purposes of that determination, thereby allowing someone to revoke that those trust assets, revoke the trust, spend the money down for the cost of their care before the state of Minnesota is responsible for paying that out. So that was in place when these trusts were created, Your Honors. So this
counsel,
can be-
just help me understand how this would work as a practical matter. The trust, in your view anyway, the trust is irrevocable as drafted, correct? The trust at issue here?
Yes, Your Honor.
And under Minnesota Statute 501C.1206, in your view, when the applicant applies for medical assistance MA, that trust becomes revocable?
Correct, Your Honor.
So then at that point, in your view or the agency's view, the individual had an obligation to revoke the trust and spend down the funds in the trust?
Correct, Your Honor, or the person who settled the trust. Otherwise, those assets should and did count in this case towards the MA applicant's eligibility threshold.
Under what law would the revocation occur? How would that revocation occur legally?
Your Honor, I believe it would just occur under the trust code, however someone would revoke a revocable trust. And in this case, under 501C.1206, it doesn't just limit or it doesn't just describe how trust assets should be counted for MA eligibility. That is in Section 256B. This is in the trust code. And there are certain provisions that would suggest that these do actually become revocable and that that statute supersedes any contrary trust provisions. And so this does allow, Your Honors, an irrevocable trust to become revocable. And that is consistent with the public policy of the state of Minnesota to have people spend down assets that they have before the public pays for somebody's public medical assistance. So
how is it consistent with federal law? Because there's obviously a preemption issue here. And on its face, this law seems to be designed to circumvent the federal treatment of revocable trusts by making what is otherwise a revocable trust. Let me rephrase that. Let me start over, sorry. So this law seems to be designed to circumvent the federal treatment of irrevocable trusts by making what is otherwise an irrevocable trust, making it become revocable when someone applies for medical assistance. So why doesn't that conflict with federal law?
I wouldn't say, Your Honor, that it tries to circumvent the federal law. It simply just makes irrevocable trust revocable when someone applies for medical assistance, long-term care. In the federal statute, in Section 1396P, there is a description of how assets are counted in the case of a revocable trust, as well as in the case of an irrevocable trust. It doesn't define either of those things, and property rights are typically created by state law. And Minnesota does have this trust code, Chapter 501C. And what happened, and it's not preempted, Your Honors, because this federal statute at issue is not talking about the actual nature of the trust. it's just saying this is how federal law treats an irrevocable trust or the assets therein. This is how federal law treats irrevocable or evocable trust. This is how the federal law treats the assets that are contained in those. Minnesota law makes irrevocable trust actually revocable. So it's consistent with federal law. Here, the analysis would be to see that under 501c.1206, the irrevocable trust became revocable, and therefore it would be the case of an irrevocable trust under federal law. They're not inconsistent, they're actually consistent. And preemption, there's a heavy burden there. For a statute to be ruled unconstitutional, it has to be shown beyond a reasonable doubt. So preemption, for the reasons stated, Your Honors, does not apply to this case. The statute causes irrevocable trust to become revocable. Counsel did also cite an estoppel argument. That wasn't argued below, and estoppel is strongly disfavored against government entities. And the Braylon decision that is cited by counsel, that is not binding state law. The district court did not create law. Court of Appeals, the legislature, Supreme Court, as this court knows, are the bodies that create law in the state of Minnesota.
Also, I have one other question for you related to 501c.1206 in your short time remaining. Are you aware of any other state that has a similar statute?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with any state that has a similar statute similar to this specific one that deals with trust. No, Your Honor. And I would respectfully reserve the opportunity to provide a rebuttal argument. Thank you, Your Honors. My time is up.
Well, before you leave, yes, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. No need to reserve it. But as to Judge Cochran's question, when you say you're not aware of any other state statute, I'm just curious, not that you had to, but did you explore? Are you saying that you've looked to see if other state statutes mirror ours with regard to the revocable, irrevocable nature of the trust? Or are you saying that you're just not aware, you haven't searched for those statutes?
I'm not aware of it. I may have searched a little, but I don't recall whether I searched extensively like for every state, no, Your Honor.
Fair enough. Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, members of the court. May it please the court, John Waldron, Waldron Law Office, is representing the respondent, Dorothy Guyon. I think the court has already keyed in on the key issue here of preemption. And to review the structure of the Medicaid laws, as the courts are aware, the federal scheme provides money to the states on the condition that their methodologies have to be consistent with federal statutes and regulations. Also, the state methodologies for determining eligibility must be no more restrictive than the federal methodology. Those points are undisputed. A state's methodology is considered no more restrictive if additional individuals may be eligible for medical assistance and no individuals who are otherwise eligible are made ineligible for such assistance. So all that's undisputed. Now, in this case, if we look at the federal law says there's nothing wrong with an irrevocable trust so long as there are no circumstances under which payment from the trust could be made to or for the benefit of the individual. On the other hand, the state methodology, which is contained within 501c.1206, says the opposite. It says there's no such thing as an irrevocable trust. If you have an irrevocable trust, we're gonna deem it, consider it revocable. The language is curious.
Counsel, this is Judge Cochran. Can I ask you a question in that regard? I think you just said that 501c.126 relates to eligibility, but if you look at the statute, I don't think it does govern eligibility. There's a separate statute in Minnesota law, 256B.056, that governs eligibility for medical assistance. Isn't that correct?
That's where the main provisions of eligibility are located. That's correct, Your Honor. But in this case,
and 501c.126 governs whether the trust is revocable or irrevocable for medical assistance purposes.
Correct, but it's clear from the language of the 501c.1206 that it's dealing with eligibility as well for medical assistance in the context of an irrevocable trust. And so what it's saying is that we're going to consider any irrevocable trust, even if it meets the requirements of the federal law, we're going to consider it revocable, and therefore it's going to become an available asset. So it's a question of available assets. There's other provisions in the medical assistance statutes per se, of course, that do deal with eligibility in various respects. But in this case, it's also dealing with eligible resources, available resources, and you know that's what created the problem in this case. The state, the facility, said, well, you've got an irrevocable trust based on this Minnesota statute. We consider it revocable, and so you have to spend down those assets within that trust. So,
is there any provision in federal law that requires a state to allow its residents to put assets into an irrevocable trust and avoid having those assets counted for medical assistance purposes?
Well, there's no requirement, but it's clearly permitted. So under the federal scheme, the person can put assets into an irrevocable trust. Now that action is still a gift, and so they would still have to wait out the 60-month look back period after doing that. But
sorry to interrupt. It's challenging when you're on the phone, I know. But you said federal law allows individuals to put their assets in a revocable trust. What language are you referring to? Because the language of 42 U.S.C. 1396p, I don't think specifies that an individual is allowed to put their assets in an irrevocable trust, but maybe I'm missing something. Help clarify that for me.
Sure. So I don't think there's language to that effect, but it talks about the treatment of the federal statute 42 U.S. Code 1396 PD3B. Does talk about the treatment of trusts. And so whether they're considered available assets or not. And so, you know, there's no requirement that somebody put assets into an irrevocable trust, but clearly it's contemplated by the language of that statute that it's something that could happen, and it is not an available resource so long as there are no circumstances in the trust under which payment from the trust could be made to or for the benefit of the individual. And if that's the case, as here, then the assets are not considered an available resource for the MA applicant. So it's our position, I think it's clear, that the methodology of the state is clearly more restrictive in contravention of the federal law I've mentioned. It's definitely
more restrictive. And by methodology, you mean the when you say the methodology of the state, you mean the law that provides that an irrevocable trust becomes revocable when an individual applies for MA.
Exactly. It's clearly.
And how is that part of the methodology? As How do you define the term methodology?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know that the term methodology is necessarily defined, but if you look at the language of 501c.1206, that's replete with discussion about application for long-term care services as defined in section 256b.0595. And it's all talking about available resources for medical assistance. So I think in a common sense view, it's definitely part of the methodology because it talks about the treatment of trusts for medical assistance application purposes. And so I think it's clearly part of the methodology of the MA program in Minnesota. Just looking at the language of the statute, of the state statute, it talks about when a state or local agency makes a determination on an application for payment of long-term care services, et cetera. And it references 256B at least a couple of times. And so it's clearly part of the state methodology.
Mr. Waldron, I'll raise with you a question that we discussed with your opponent. And it just, in my mind, it just goes to whether this is really a case of first impression. Were you able to determine in your research whether Minnesota's 1206 statute is unique or whether other states have are using such what you call methodology, have enacted such a law? And if so, do you know whether this issue has been litigated elsewhere?
To my knowledge, there is no other state that has a statute such as 501c.1206. I can't represent to the court that I've made an exhaustive survey of the nation any more than appellant's counsel can, but I think Minnesota is clearly an outlier in this regard. I'm not aware of any other statute like this that says, well, you basically can't have an irrevocable trust, even though it conforms to federal law, and have that not be counted as a resource. So we feel the language of the Braylon decision, as well as the district court in this case, is exactly on point. It's logical. It clearly shows how the methodology in Minnesota is more restrictive. There's a class of people that would qualify for medical assistance and not have their irrevocable trust counted as an available resource that have it counted under the state methodology and this statute. So it's clearly a case of preemption.
You don't dispute, though, that... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge.
No, you
don't dispute that states have the authority and are recognized by federal law as the body that establishes property rights, including what is and what is not a revocable trust or an irrevocable trust.
No, I don't dispute that. But in the context of medical assistance, they do fall under that federal statutory mandate that they have to comply their methodology with the federal. And that's clearly not happening here. The state's methodology is clearly more restrictive, and 501c.1206 is clearly part of the state's methodology, regardless of whether it's placed in the trust code as it is or in the chapter 256B. It's clearly part of the same methodology. It's clear from the language of that statute.
Counsel, you say it's more restrictive, but under state law, the trust becomes revocable, and under federal law, the assets of a revocable trust can be counted towards MA assistance. So if the trust truly is revocable, isn't it consistent with federal law in terms of allowing for those assets to be counted in determining MA eligibility?
If we were dealing with a revocable trust, then that's true. But what Minnesota's done here is they've said that we're going to consider your irrevocable trust revocable for the sole purpose of MA determination. And so I don't think the state can say something is black when it's white and have itself claiming to be in conformity with federal law. I could think of a number of circumstances where someone could do something like that and say, well, no, I consider myself, I consider myself an adult, even though I'm a minor. You know, I consider myself a member of a protected class, even though I'm not, to circumvent the federal scheme. And as the justices have indicated earlier, that's exactly what's happening here. It really is a circumvention of their duties to comply with federal law.
Mr. Waldron, does your argument depend on the point that you, the factual procedural circumstance that, as you say, this is the sole purpose of the eligible of the revocable versus irrevocable nature of the trust, the sole purpose being MA eligibility?
Well, if I understand the question correctly, in this case, it's the state that's used 501c.1206 to attempt to prevail here, stating that, well, we can, by reason of the language in the statute, we can just consider that your irrevocable trust is revocable. And so I think that the legitimacy of 501c.1206 is key to the appellant's case. My point is that the language of that statute is clearly preempted by the federal methodology, and therefore it's in contravention of federal law, and therefore preempted. With regard to the other issue that counsel mentioned regarding the Brayland case, the Crow Wing County District Court case being binding, you know, we're relying on the language of the Federal District Court for the District of Minnesota in a very similar situation, where it indicated that because there was a decision in another county that was never appealed, that decision is now binding state law. That was the reasoning of the District Court for the District of Minnesota. So, but I don't think the court has to rely on the binding nature of Brayland to find for the respondent in this matter. It can find and should find for the respondent based upon this clear issue of preemption. So we feel that there's abundant basis where this court can and should, in fact, uphold the decision of the district court in this matter, and that's what we're requesting.
Thank you, Mr. Waldron. Your time has expired. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Aliyev Sharjavan, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Minnesota, on behalf of the Commissioner of Human Services. I would just like to note that the methodology in Minnesota is not more restrictive than the federal methodology. The methodology is in Section 256B, 0.056, and the statute at issue here with regard to making irrevocable trusts revocable, that is in the trust code. Also, it doesn't apply to every trust. There are provisions in there, I believe, that they don't apply to special needs trusts or pools or pooled trusts, and they don't apply to trusts that were made prior to July 1st, 2005. In this case, the irrevocable trusts at issue were formed after the statute was enacted. It was codified somewhere else, as stated. In 2011, these trusts were created. This was before the Brayland decision was issued. The Brayland decision is not binding law. And ultimately what happened in this case is that the trust assets in this irrevocable trust, they were spent and used for the cost of Ms. Guyon's care. And that's the whole point. So the assets that are in question in this case, they were spent properly in the end to pay for the cost of Ms. Guyon's care.
Counsel, you argue that the provision in 501c.1206 that provides that an irrevocable trust becomes revocable for the sole purpose of the medical assistance determination is not part of the state's methodology because of where the statute is codified. But isn't that really placing, you know, form over substance? Because the statute is focused on MA, medical assistance determination. It's revocable only for that purpose. So can you explain why we shouldn't consider it to be part of the methodology, the state's methodology?
Yes, Your Honor. So section 501c.1206, it does state the public policy in paragraph A as well, and also the for the sole purpose of that determination language. Determination is not necessarily, it doesn't happen necessarily in a moment in time. It is someone applies, the county makes a decision. Sometimes there can be a correspondence from a county saying that a applicant needs to spend down assets. That happened in this case. So it's not necessarily a snapshot. Like, someone can apply and work to become eligible. And as in this case, or what could have happened in this case is Ms. Guyon could have revoked the trust, spent down the money, and became eligible for MA, didn't have her assets exceeding the $3,000 asset threshold. If this statute were to be read to say that this counts towards someone's MA eligibility, or a irrevocable trust is merely treated as revocable, and then did not allow them any sort of mechanism to spend down the money, I think that would be causing that applicant to essentially be stuck, and that can't be what the meaning of the statute is. That would be an absurd outcome. And the Minnesota legislature does not intend to make absurd statutes, as this court knows. Also, as stated previously, this statute, it's grounded in state law. Property rights are governed by state law. It's not just some hypothetical thing. The Minnesota legislature has decided in these circumstances that an irrevocable trust becomes revocable when someone applies for medical assistance long-term care.
So right, but usually you say that, usually I believe that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this idea that the federal law is going to defer to state law when it comes to the determination of property rights is in the context of the state generally determining property rights, not determining property rights specifically in a manner that is designed to alter how federal law is applied. Am I correct about the general reasoning for, or the basis for federal deference to state law as to property rights?
Your Honor, I would say that the state law does create general property rights, and it's perhaps true that federal law can affect any sort of outcome based on those property rights. But in this case, the section 1396P does not define trust. It doesn't prohibit the state from doing something like this. It just says, this is how federal law treats irrevocable trust. This is how federal law treats revocable trust in instances where someone applies for medical assistance. And the Minnesota legislature has decided, if you want to create a trust in Minnesota after 2005, that if you later apply for medical assistance long-term care, that irrevocable trust becomes revocable. So the state statute and the federal statute, they are consistent, and there's no preemption, Your Honor. And the commissioner would respectfully request this court to affirm the decision of the fair hearing judge below and reverse the district court. And if the court does believe that there's no subject matter jurisdiction here or below, that the court would vacate the order of the district court below. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your argument today and for bearing with us through our technical challenges. Just a reminder to counsel, when you have an oral argument scheduled and the court provides you for an opportunity to test your connection and test your equipment, you should avail yourself of that just to make sure that your connectivity issues are resolved before the hearing begins. With that, counsel, thank you for your presentation today and for your written briefs. Matter is submitted.